Do you know about these stories? In 1933, Huey Long invented a holiday to prevent a bank from collapsing. In 1963, years before he was assassinated, someone tried to kill JFK with a car bomb. And in 2014, remember this? There was a whole news cycle about President Obama's tan suit. On the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History, we talk about the forgotten stories that may teach us a lot about the very strange moment we're living in right now. Check it out. This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia.
Vladimir Putin spoke with Tucker Carlson and repeated Kremlin talking points, but Putin also hinted that an American journalist behind bars in Russia could be set free.
I do not rule out that the person you refer to, Mr. Gershkovitz, may return to his motherland.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Afghanistan, women's rights advocates say the Taliban are imposing gender apartheid on the country.
You cannot be anybody. You cannot exist outside of your home as a woman.
Also, why asylum became the primary pathway for migrants arriving in the U.S.
And how audio description brings the art of dance alive for the visually impaired.
I encourage people to use their accents and their own language when they're creating audio description.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us today. In Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin granted a rare interview, this time to the former Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson. And the pre-taped segment went online last night.
This was the first time that Putin sat down to speak with a Western broadcaster since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The World's Daniel Offman is in Poland, and he watched the full interview closely.
The interview lasted about 2 hours, and I would say about half of it, Putin described his view of Russian history. So his view is this kind of mix of nationalist, revisionist history that really boils down to denying the existence of Ukraine. So in Putin's mind, Ukraine is Russia, and Russia is Ukraine. And that's one of the many ways that Putin justifies Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So all of these messages are straight out of the Kremlin's propaganda playbook, and that's nothing new.
So beyond the usual Kremlin talking points, the propaganda playbook, as you say, did Putin offer anything surprising in this conversation?
Well, Carolyn, there was one surprise that came towards the end of the interview. Carlson asked Putin about the fate of the Wall Street Journal's Evan Gershkovich. He's an American reporter who's been behind bars in Russia based on trumped-up espionage charges. And it's worth mentioning that Carlson didn't ask about other U.S. citizens who have been wrongfully detained in Russia, people like Paul Whelan and also Kurmasheva. But Carlson asked if the U.S. and Russia could come to a deal that would free Gershkovich. And Putin said that talks are already happening. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
I do not rule out that the person you refer to, Mr. Gershkovitz, may return to his motherland. By the end of the day, it does not make any sense to keep him in prison in Russia. We want the U.S. Special Services to think about how they can contribute to achieving the goals our Special Services are pursuing.
So Gershkovich, who the U.S. State Department views as wrongfully detained, is being used right now as a trade chip by the Kremlin.
Okay, so we've heard about Gershkovich and also Putin's pseudo-historical war justification. What else stood out to you, Daniel, in this long conversation with Tucker Carlson?
Well, Putin's tone stood out to me. He was speaking to an American, but he was very anti-U.S. throughout, and at times he even sounded irritated. Putin blamed the U.S. again and again for working against Russia and trying to undermine its interests. And his view of the U.S. is also kind of how he views the war in Ukraine. For Putin, it's always Russia against the U.S. He doesn't give Ukraine and its leaders much agency. Here's Putin again talking through an interpreter.
The U.S.-led West supports them and will always support those who antagonize with Russia.
So on top of saying that the U.S. controls Ukraine, Putin frequently talks about the CIA, which maybe isn't so surprising since he's a former KGB officer himself. but he often overemphasizes the role that intelligence officials play in shaping politics.
Mm. So it seems like Putin is trying to get a message across to Western and specifically an American audience by granting this conversation with Tucker Carlson. But what was the reaction in Russia and among Russian journalists?
Well, Carolyn, it depends which Russians and which journalists we're talking about. So if we're talking about Russian state-controlled media, they've been fans of Tucker Carlson for a long time.
Самый популярный в США телеведущий Такер Карлсон.
Самый популярный в Америке журналист Такер Карлсон.
Hosts on Russian state TV were really hyping up the interview. Their message was that Americans are afraid of the truth and that Carlsson is the only American journalist who represents an alternative point of view that's closer to the Kremlin's perspective. However, many independent Russian journalists really had a totally different reaction. Most of them are now in exile, and many of them are highly critical of Carlsson for giving Putin this platform to repeat his justifications of the war in Ukraine. Carlsson really didn't push back on many of Putin's answers, and for those Russians opposed to the war in Ukraine, who are denied the ability to work freely as journalists in Russia, an interview like this goes against their standards.
That was The World's Daniel Offman speaking to us from Eastern Poland.
For the past 2.5 years, since American forces pulled out of Afghanistan, the Taliban have been imposing severe restrictions on women, on their education, employment, and freedom of expression. A new slate of Taliban policies are now making life even more difficult for Afghan women. The World's Shirin Jafari has this report.
Every time 25-year-old Sahar Mahmood wants to leave the house, she has to answer one question: which one of her male relatives is going to accompany her? That's because there's a new informal rule restricting women from being in public by themselves. Say I want to go to the bank, she says, or I need to buy some groceries. I have to ask my dad if he can come with me. Her dad, she says, has been suffering from back problems, and he's had surgery twice. Mahmood says she feels awful even asking him. She also doesn't have a brother, she tells me, from the Afghan capital. Mahmood is the sole breadwinner of her family. Before the Taliban takeover, she says, she had her own car and used to drive. Now, her whole day revolves around coordinating her outings. A recent report by the United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan found that the Taliban have tightened restrictions on women and girls. Farhonda Akbari is a researcher at Monash University in Australia.
You cannot be anybody. You cannot exist outside of your home as a woman.
As part of her research, Akbari has interviewed women and girls all across Afghanistan. She's found that those who belong to ethnic groups like the Hazaras or the Tajiks are treated even worse.
In the prison, in the Taliban's prison, when they're not, you're a Hazara woman, the way they punish you is different. It's a lot harsher. The Taliban's sort of characterizing these women based on their cultural, religious or ethnic identities.
The UN report found similar allegations. Additionally, it said that officials from the Department of the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice warned women healthcare workers to get married or risk losing their jobs. In another case, they arrested two women for buying contraceptives. The report says they were released after their families signed a guarantee that they would not buy contraceptives again.
They regulate every aspect of women's lives, and there has been calls from Afghan women themselves that this needs to be recognized by the international community.
Sometimes witnesses record and share the arrests and mistreatment of women in public. This one, shared online last week, allegedly shows a mother and daughter being taken away in a van for not wearing proper hijab. Sohail Shaheen, a spokesperson for the Taliban, rejected these claims. In a message, he wrote that Afghans are equal in front of the law and ethnic minorities are not treated differently. He called the online videos, quote, rumors. Shaheen didn't respond to follow-up questions. Farhonda Akbari, the researcher, has put forward some practical steps that Western governments can take to help Afghan women.
We need to identify and understand that there is a kind of gender-based crime happening in Afghanistan, known as gender apartheid. Recognize it, criminalize it.
provide scholarships for Afghan women, she says, so that they can study abroad, engage local human rights activists, and keep the spotlight on Afghanistan. Sahar Mahmood, who lives in Kabul, says she too is staying active. She studied civil engineering and lost her job after the Taliban takeover in 2021. After months of dealing with depression and hopelessness, Mahmood started an online group for women engineers. She says they come together regularly to speak about the latest trends in civil engineering, to talk about jobs and education opportunities outside Afghanistan. But more importantly, she adds, it's a way to stay connected and to remind themselves that they're not alone. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Tomorrow is the start of Chinese New Year celebrations and the beginning, according to the Chinese zodiac cycle, of the Year of the Dragon. That means crunch time for dragon and lion dance troupes all over the world. These traditional dances are a regular part of Chinese New Year celebrations and believed to bring good luck. The world's Sarah Birnbaum hung out with Xin Fong Dragon and Lion Dance Team in Sydney, Australia.
There's no flow for it. It's 5 minutes to showtime, and the dancers in their blue and silver uniforms huddle off to the side of the concourse. They're mapping out a route, talking strategy.
It's very difficult because coordination and timing is everything.
Ivan Tran is the one calling the shots. He's the head of the dragon.
Since I'm the head, I have the responsibility of determining what moves to do, what shape to do, and like I'm just running around and they got to follow, basically.
In this dance, nine people hold a 50-foot-long dragon puppet on poles over their heads. Ivan's job is to get them to work together, to become a flying, writhing, twisting creature.
What the animal is, or the creature is, we have to kind of make it so it is an animal, not just a human underneath.
So you want people to look at you and not say, like, oh, that's nine people under a puppet.
Yes, exactly.
You want them to say, oh my God, that's a dragon.
That's a dragon, or that's a lion, but yeah, pretty much.
The huddle breaks. The dancers take their places under the ribbon of fabric. But before the dance begins, the dragon must be awakened. A man walks the length of the dragon. He sweeps a horsehair brush over the papier-mâché horns, eyes, nose, teeth, down the spine to the tip of the tail. Creature starts to twitch. The head pokes up, looks around, and bobs to the rhythm. The dragon begins to chase a pearl, which here is represented by an orange ball at the top of a pole. The pearl stands for wisdom, and the dragon will never catch it. For the next 30 minutes, the dancers run in circles and figure eights, making the body of the dragon turn and twist on itself. Kelvin Tran is the co-founder of the Xin Fong Dragon and Lion Dance Team. He says demand is through the roof.
This year, we've got about 120 performances over the course of 3 weeks, which is pretty crazy.
On Saturday, the start of the new year, they will have 20 performances in a single day. Kelvin is prepared. He's splitting up the dance troupe into three teams so they can cover more ground, and he bought another dragon puppet from China. This one in the team colors, blue and silver.
We're still waiting for it to come through, but I think that's going to look awesome.
All around, kids are squealing and laughing. They do their own dances to the drums and cymbals. Parents and grandparents smile and look on. The Chinese New Year is about new beginnings and positivity. And the dragon is here in the hopes that it will bring good luck and chase away bad spirits. From the looks and the faces in the crowd, the dragon has already worked its magic. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
Record numbers of people are showing up at the southern border, hoping to start new lives here in the United States. Most of them are applying for asylum. Up next, how that process became the main legal pathway for getting residency here in the U.S. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The last time Congress passed major reforms on immigration policy, Ronald Reagan was president. This week, Republican Party leaders killed a bipartisan attempt at reform. Meanwhile, unprecedented numbers of migrants are arriving at the U.S. southern border. Most of them are requesting asylum here, and that has overwhelmed immigration courts. The World's Tibis Isaiah reports on how asylum became the main avenue for mass migration to the United States.
There is an undeniable fact. The U.S. needs more immigrants. It needs a lot of them, according to Giovanni Pieri, who studies migration economics at the University of California, Davis.
So there are about 6 million jobs which cannot be filled even by local unemployed. Keep in mind that in the U.S., a lot of these unfilled jobs are in hotel, restaurant service, assistance of people with health problems.
The reality is that in the U.S., there aren't a lot of options for low-skilled workers to come to the U.S. legally.
The U.S. does not allow any immigrant who is not a college-educated to come to the U.S. to do a job unless you have a family person in the U.S. So it's very restrictive.
And because of this, asylum has become the de facto alternative. Migrants are increasingly choosing to show up at the U.S.-Mexico border, turn themselves in, and apply for asylum. Now, the asylum system is overwhelmed, with close to 3 million applications pending in court. Asylum seekers are waiting an average of 4.5 years for their cases to be resolved.
Many people have realized that if you make it to the U.S. border, the chances of getting in are very high. And then if you apply for asylum, you won't get a hearing for years. And during that time, you can work legally.
Muzaffar Chishti is with the Migration Policy Institute. He says the asylum system has become the main avenue for mass migration to the U.S., something it wasn't originally designed to do. The asylum system, as we know it, goes back to 1951. The U.S., Canada, and most countries in Europe signed the UN Refugee Convention, initially to protect Jewish people around the world.
And one of the key aspects of the Refugee Convention was that if somebody is on your soil and they say, I fear for my life, if you send me back to my country, we're not going to send you back right away. We will at least give you due process.
Adam Isaacson works on border security at the Washington Office on Latin America. He says the UN Refugee Convention also defined an eligibility criteria for asylum seekers, which became standard.
You have to prove that more likely than not, if returned to your country, you would be killed, imprisoned, tortured because of your race, religion, your nationality, your political belief, or your membership in a particular social group.
Many migrants have a well-founded case based on that criteria, but others are fleeing general violence in their countries or economic hardship. And those claims are not acceptable for asylum. Kathleen Bush Joseph is the author of a recent study on U.S. asylum. She says the success of asylum cases depends largely on access to an immigration lawyer.
Without legal representation, it's extremely difficult for people to navigate the process.
She says to relieve the border crisis, it's crucial to fix the asylum system, to hire more judges and speed up the process.
Because people who need protection are not getting it, and people who are not eligible for protection are not being removed.
But fixing the asylum system won't solve the underlying problem at the border, according to Randall Hansen. He studies global migration at the University of Toronto.
There's no way for migrant workers, whom America needs, to come to the United States legally. So it is an internally self-generated crisis.
He says the ultimate solution for the border crisis is in the hands of Congress. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
The border all those asylum seekers are crossing from Mexico into the U.S. stretches for almost 2,000 miles. In remote parts of San Diego County in Southern California, people have been crossing through openings in the border wall. A group of reporters from iNewsSource recently traveled to the Jacumba Desert and spent 48 hours in the migrant encampments that sit along the border. Cody Delaney was one of them.
In the small town of Jacumba, the border wall stops where the mountains begin. It's just before dawn, and dozens of migrants are piling out of trucks and SUVs south of the border. The drivers are rushing them along. Men, women, and children climb over rocks and boulders around the steel barricades that form the border wall. Most are carrying bags. Some are carrying babies. All have high hopes for the future. This scene is so common, something of a system has developed. As soon as migrants cross through gaps in the wall, they look for Border Patrol. Agents funnel them into makeshift outdoor holding areas, where they can wait hours, sometimes days, to be processed. They often have no food or water, with barely more than the clothes on their backs. And in this rugged, high desert region, where dramatic swings in temperature are common, it can get dangerous. An 18-year-old from Egypt learns this firsthand. His group had arrived after walking several hours in 40-degree weather, with high winds and horizontal rain. Minutes later, the young man collapses. Border Patrol agents on scene call for help. Within 16 minutes, CAL FIRE paramedics arrive. The young man is breathing, but unresponsive.
Sir! 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 Wake up! Open your eyes! Open your eyes!
His body is shivering. One paramedic touches his hand and says it's ice cold. They check his blood pressure. 150 over 90. That's high for his age. Next, his body temperature. 95 degrees. Dangerously close to hypothermia. Paramedics quickly load him onto a truck and drive off. Volunteers say they've seen a big improvement in response times. After repeated medical emergencies out here, they say things have changed. Migration is often driven by people fleeing danger or searching for something better, sometimes both. While conditions can be harsh, the camps mark the beginning of a new life. A teacher from Colombia named Monica Alejandra Suaza Gomez is here with her 15-year-old daughter. She hopes to keep her daughter's dreams for the future alive. She says she sees the possibility of living safely. Back home, she's afraid they were going to die. Those with young children do what they can to make the best of long wait times. One family from China, none of whom speak English, are making breakfast around a campfire. A man in the group grabs plastic poles from a nearby, broken-down tent. He lays them on the fire, side by side, long ways, creating something that resembles a grill.
Oh my God!
He carefully places a dumpling on top. He moves it around, turns it over. He doesn't have much time before the plastic melts. And then, with a slip of his hand, it falls into the flames. For the World, I'm Cody Delaney on the California-Mexico border.
You're with the World. The late Seiji Ozawa set himself apart as a young conductor, winning accolades in his home country of Japan, in Europe, and here in the U.S.
He could just digest a score in minutes. He would just flip through the score and be able to understand what was going on in the score and then get in front of an orchestra and show what he wanted almost supernaturally.
The life of Seiji Ozawa, ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Quebec is intensely proud of being part of the Francophone world. There's also tension there over keeping and preserving that French language. That's a big reason why a tuition hike for university students arriving in Quebec from English-speaking parts of Canada has unleashed a controversy.
The plan is for tuition to go up from $9,000 to $12,000. That might not sound so steep to Americans, but it's a big deal for renowned universities in Quebec, like McGill and Concordia. Earlier today, I spoke with Jacob Robbins-Cantor. He's an assistant professor at Bishop's University in Quebec. I asked him if the tuition hike is for anyone who arrives at an English language school in Quebec from outside the province.
Yes, it does, with one exception, which is Bishop's University, actually. So Bishop's University is the smallest of the three English language universities in Quebec. That's where I teach, in fact. And Bishop's has an exemption essentially at the current level of out-of-province student enrollments that we have.
And that's because Bishop's is a smaller school to begin with.
That's right. It's a smaller school, and also it's not located in Montreal, and it's perceived that the French language is, you could say, in decline or under threat in the city of Montreal, but much less so once you go outside of the city.
I see. So it's the premier of Quebec who is mandating this tuition rise. A premier is kind of like a U.S. governor. What's his reason?
They're claiming that this will help to address the underfunding of French language universities in Quebec relative to English language universities, of which there are only three, the three English ones I mentioned earlier. But there's obviously a larger number of French language universities because Quebec is a majority French-speaking province. And if we look at the distribution of funds available to the universities over the years, there is this imbalance where the English universities on a per capita basis are just much better off financially. So part of this increase is intended to take the extra funds and then redistribute those to the French language university network. And the other, as I mentioned earlier, to basically address the decline of French in Montreal. Lastly, the government has mentioned that it's costing them significant money to subsidize the undergraduate education of students from other provinces who then tend not to stay, I should say, in Quebec after they graduate.
What have the universities said?
As you can imagine, they're pretty upset, the English language universities. Initially, this was going to be a doubling of the tuition fees for out-of-province students. Now it's $12,000, as you mentioned. So when we initially saw this, the universities thought it was going to be catastrophic, that we would lose almost all of our out-of-province students. And because funding is basically on a per-student basis, losing, for example, Bishops, if we lost 30% of our student body, which is roughly the proportion that's out of province, the university probably couldn't continue to exist. Thankfully, in the case of Bishops, we saw an exemption provided, and the increase to $12,000 was maybe, you could say, somewhat of a compromise because it didn't go up to $17,000. But it's still really problematic for the other universities that are affected, Concordia and McGill, in terms of their financial viability, in terms of their ability to recruit top talented students from across Canada, in terms of their reputation, perhaps globally. McGill in particular has a very strong global reputation, and any policy that's seen to put that at risk is going to be controversial as well.
But what's the evidence that out-of-province students simply won't apply to McGill, given the fact that it's a place like McGill, given the fact that it's such a well-known and respected university?
The evidence does show that applications to McGill are down quite a bit from out-of-province students. Some were claiming exactly that well, McGill will continue to attract people because of its reputation. But I think it's fair to say that because there are other strong universities in the country that will compete with McGill to attract some of the best and brightest students, if you had the choice to go to McGill and pay $12,000, or you can go to University of Toronto or University of British Columbia and pay $6,000 or $7,000, that is going to start to become a problem for McGill at a certain point. But again, I think it's a significant concern for McGill and also for Concordia, which is a lesser known but a really large institution in the city of Montreal too.
Jacob Robbins-Cantor is an assistant professor at Bishop's University in Quebec, where he teaches politics and international studies. He was explaining a controversial plan to raise tuition at English language universities in the Canadian province of Quebec.
You can get a lot out of going to a dance performance just by listening to the music, to the dancers' feet hitting the floor after jumps. But if you're visually impaired, you can miss out on what it all looks like. Theaters these days are trying to help with that. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on one strategy.
Zoe Partington has long loved all kinds of art and performances. But when she lost her sight 30 years ago, she thought she'd never be able to enjoy those works like before.
So I became quite interested in how do blind or partially blind people still interact in art and culture and heritage. So I started doing more investigation myself.
Her research led her to what's called audio descriptions, which are essentially a recording of someone saying aloud what's happening on stage. Here's an example from the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater in New York.
Leaving her corner, the woman strides back to the man and stomps. He picks her up, then spins her on one leg.
In the UK, Louise Fryer has been creating audio descriptions for dance since the 90s. She says most often, people listen to them via headphones.
Because the idea was that you wouldn't interfere with the performance, so only the person who needed the description would listen to it.
Fryer says the key to a quality audio description is balancing details with brevity.
So you don't want to talk all over the music, but you want to give enough cues that a blind person knows what's going on, where it's happening, and how it's happening.
That can be accomplished not only with the chosen words, but also with the pacing and delivery.
People can leap and land, and so the kind of sense of the suspension in the air can be replicated in the way you deliver the line.
Zoe Partington, who is now a disability dance consultant herself, says for her, audio descriptions have made all the difference.
I felt like I was maybe getting a better offer than sighted people because it was so sharp, they were so skilled, and it was just fascinating. And it sort of brought all of that visual world back to me, and it just brought it to life.
Recently, the audio description industry has seen a shift, with some typically smaller productions creating more exploratory and innovative audio descriptions.
The dancer crosses the room, one foot in front of the other, looking shocked to be moving. They lift their foot up, toe grazing the floor, before twisting their hip side to side.
A 2022 film called Telephone explores all of the senses in its audio descriptions of dance. The U.S.-based filmmakers say dance is visceral, not merely visual. They're part of a small but growing group of artists making audio descriptions that enhance the performance for people with any level of sight.
The dancers take their skirts and begin to turn on their own axis. Their dance is a ritual.
Christopher Nunez, a visually impaired choreographer, combined audio descriptions with poetry in his live dance performance called The Circle or Prophetic Dream. He, too, has moved away from the somewhat robotic audio descriptions of years past and plays them aloud in the theaters for the entire audience to hear.
He fills the space with poetry and frequencies of the universe.
As an immigrant from Costa Rica, Nunez is also focused on diversifying the work.
Audio description as a practice has been developing for a number of years in English-speaking only countries. And so the idea is that audio describers need to be English speakers.
Nunez says when he first started creating audio descriptions in the U.S., he was told his accent was an issue.
That was really like a breaking point in my practice because then I realized the lack of representation in access services, especially audio description.
Nunez now folds his native language, Spanish, into his productions.
The bodies are sculptures in movement. Las cuerpos abrazan sus casas.
Sometimes he translates the English lines directly into Spanish, and sometimes there are sections that are only in Spanish. Moving forward, this is how Nunez wants to see audio describers change the industry.
If they come from a different background, if they are Chinese, if they are Japanese, Latin Americans, Africans, I encourage people to use their accents and their own language when they're creating audio description as a form of representation.
He says the question is whether foundations and dance companies will be able to provide enough funding for these enhanced accessibility services. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And now let's catch you up on some news you might have missed.
Iceland is under a state of emergency. A volcanic eruption has disrupted water supplies for some 20,000 residents. This was the third eruption since December on a peninsula that juts off the southwest coast of Iceland. Bright orange lava streams have been pouring out of a crack in the Earth's surface that's nearly 2 miles long. The Reykjanes Peninsula has 6 active volcanic systems. Experts warn that these eruptions could continue for decades and maybe even centuries into the future.
In Greece, lawmakers are preparing to legalize same-sex marriage. The country is one of the last European Union members to allow gay marriage. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said, quote, It is not something radically different from what applies in other European countries. But it is radically different from other countries with large majorities of Orthodox Christians, including Russia, which has been cracking down on LGBTQ rights in recent years.
And in the United Kingdom, Prince Harry has settled a phone hacking suit against Mirror Group newspapers. It may have to pay well over £1 million British to cover damages and legal fees. The prince is still locked in a battle with other tabloids accused of privacy violations. Harry said today that, quote, our mission continues. I believe in the positive change it will bring for all of us. It is the very reason why I started this and why I will continue to see it through to the end.
And that's a few things you might have missed. The tiny Buddhist kingdom of Bhutan, population less than 1 million, sits in the Himalayas, near China, India, and Nepal. It's always been isolated from the rest of the world. Television only came to Bhutan in 1998. But a new feature film takes us inside Bhutan as the country begins a major transition. The film is set in 2006, and in this scene, a Buddhist monk, in red and saffron robes, is tuning a portable radio. The plot revolves around an election, the very first, for Bhutan. That crackly radio newscast is about the king stepping down. He wants his people to select a new leader through something called voting. The challenge here is that the Bhutanese people don't have any experience with democracy. Pao Chuning Dorje is from Bhutan. He wrote and directed the film. It's called The Monk and the Gun. Pao, your movie is fiction, but you lived through this chapter of Bhutan's recent history. What did it mean to the Bhutanese people when their king decided to step down?
Well, you know, as I show in the movie, change was very unpopular when it was first announced, because for the people of Bhutan, the king was very popular. We did not have any reason to want change. For me as a filmmaker, I draw a lot of inspiration from actual events. I did my research, I interviewed election officers and discussed about what were the challenges they faced when they went into the villages trying to implement the king's command for democratization. And a lot of those things you see in the movie, you know, people really, really did not want this change. It was very unpopular and they felt like, oh, you know, you all are teaching us to be rude, as I show in the movie.
Rude as in kind of picking sides and making choices and campaigning and promoting themselves?
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. Bhutan is a culture that really celebrates and venerates the quality of innocence. And I think when you do have modern values, when democracy comes in, such as campaigning, standing up for your belief and all that, sometimes this innocence can be mistaken as ignorance. And that's what I was trying to show with the movie, that the importance of the quality of innocence.
It comes through. It comes through in the film, the sense of innocence, it really does, and the kind of contrast of the transformation going on in Bhutan. You have some interesting plot lines. I mean, while Bhutanese poll workers give villagers a crash course in voting, you cut to the airport where an American has just arrived. He's driven to a monastery to make an important purchase. And this is where the title comes in, The Monk and the Gun.
This is an American Civil War rifle. Look at the serial number. This one is so rare. We've been searching for this all over the world for the last 30 years.
Now, this American, this character, he's not your average brash businessman. He's kind of quiet and sweet. How did you come up with his character?
Well, you know, for me, each one of the characters that I created for this movie symbolizes and personifies the different values that are coming into Bhutan. You know, the monk personifying tradition, culture, devotion, the election officer trying to make the people evolve and, you know, modernize, the villagers caught in the middle who are innocent. But when the audience watched this film, I didn't want them to feel like, oh, this movie has a political message, or Pao is trying to say that he's pro-democracy, or he's anti-democracy, he's anti-gun. I didn't want people to watch this and be like, oh, Pao is, you know, stereotyping the American characters to be like this, you know, to be very brash. So I was very careful about that. And I think also working with non-professional actors, all the actors in this film are non-professionals acting, making their screen debut. So I think it's a combination of all that.
Now, Bhutan's gross national happiness index, it's known worldwide.
Mm.
And yet in your movie, there are characters whose lives are being pulled apart by the election campaigning. And democracy is supposed to be something that's good and forward moving. Is it fair to say Bhutan's reputation for happiness was being put to the test in that transformation?
Oh, definitely. I always tell people, Bhutan is a very unique country. You know, we actually have like a ministry of happiness. How rare is that? But then, you know, our happiness is based on our Buddhist culture and tradition. So happiness is born out of contentment and acceptance of impermanence. But on top of that, being Buddhist, also we believe in the law of interdependence. So we believe that if all the cause and conditions externally manifest happiness and goodwill, then that will impact the individual's happiness. But of course, you know, it's very difficult, Carol, to be a poor country that is pursuing happiness with these values, living in a materialistic modern world where happiness is dictated by wealth, you know, materialistic wealth.
Hmm.
So in this modern world, I'll be the first one to admit, Bhutan is suffering like any other third world country, like any poor country, because it's difficult being a happy poor country in a world that marches to a different beat in terms of happiness. But I can still say with so much pride that I come from a country that still puts this kind of happiness before everything else. And we are still in the pursuit of that happiness.
Pao Chuning Dorje is from Bhutan. He's the writer and director of the film The Monk and the Gun.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. The classical music world has lost a towering figure. Seiji Ozawa, who led the Boston Symphony Orchestra for nearly three decades, died this week at the age of 88 in his home country of Japan. To tell us more about Ozawa's life and legacy, we reached out to Brian McCreath. He broadcasts the Boston Symphony Orchestra on WCRB right here in Boston. Brian, Seiji Ozawa was born in part of Japanese-occupied China in 1935, before the end of World War II. And I understand his career took off here in this country in the 60s. Tell us how that all got started.
It really kind of started in Europe. He won a competition in France, which caught the notice of another legendary Boston Symphony music director. That's Charles Munch, who invited Seiji to come to Boston really to study at Tanglewood at the Berkshire Music Center. It was known as the Berkshire Music Center at the time, now called the Tanglewood Music Center.
In Western Massachusetts.
In Western Massachusetts, where the Boston Symphony spends the summers along with its academy there, again, the Berkshire Music Center. Seiji was one of the conductors there who studied with Munch and with others and won the Koussevitzky Prize, which is kind of a big deal, given to the best conducting student of the summer every year. And so that brought him to the attention of a ton of people. And then his career really took off through the 1960s.
And when he joined the BSO, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, in the early 1970s, how big of a deal was it to have a conductor from Japan in a role like that?
It was maybe not unprecedented, but extremely unconventional. So Seiji was coming in at a time when the orchestra had gone through a few years of music directorship of William Steinberg, a German conductor. And previous to that, several years had been spent with Eric Leinsdorf, an Austrian conductor. So there's this very heavy Central European focus that the BSO had, both in its sound approach and in its sort of profile internationally. So you bring in Seiji, who is extremely gifted, sort of supernaturally gifted almost as a conductor, and he brought with him an audience in Japan and throughout Asia. And all of a sudden, there was a new group of people paying attention to the Boston Symphony. It launched the Boston Symphony, already an international orchestra, to a new level of renown around the world. And frankly, the audience connection to the Boston Symphony in Asia remains to this day.
I gather that there was a sense among classical music critics that someone from Asia couldn't really understand Western classical music back when he took the helm of the BSO. And I was struck by this quote in the Boston Globe back in 1999. Ozawa told the Globe, "I know I am a test case. Everyone wonders how much I can learn, how much I can understand." Can you put that into context for us?
Well, there is a bias, especially back in the 1960s and early 70s, such a prevalent bias of sort of tradition and heritage being part of classical music, that you must come from a certain part of the world to understand the soul of classical music. And frankly, a lot of Europeans felt that way about the United States, too. So when Seiji comes along, not only does he disprove this comprehensively, what he brings as well is a brilliance of conducting that very few conductors have ever matched. He brought a physicality to his art that was almost, as I've heard it described, like a ballet dancer. Everything he did physically communicated what he wanted from the musicians in the nuance and the interpretation of the music they were playing.
I think you said that his conducting was like watching a ballet dance. Can you tell me a little bit more about what it looked like to watch him conduct?
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a large man physically. He was a little bit on the diminutive side, but he had this, for most of his career, he had this big hair, kind of a mop top hair, right? And so when you watched him, he was graceful. His body would bend in certain ways and move in certain ways in time with the music. Now, sometimes we in the audience watch conductors, and it's almost as though they're performing the music physically. That wasn't the case so much with Seiji. It all had a meaning. In fact, one BSO executive at one point told me that he watched in a masterclass Seiji teach students to begin pieces of music, like, say, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, actually one of the hardest pieces of music to conduct at the very beginning. He would teach his students to do that with no hands, no arms. They would have to do it basically with their eyes and facial expression. That's the kind of thing that he could pull off. Now, of course, he did use his hands and arms when he conducted that music in a concert, but that was the extent to which the physicality of the music moved through his body and communicated to the musicians in the orchestra.
Wow. Conducting just with a raised eyebrow or a glance sounds very powerful.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You mentioned that Ozawa revitalized the Boston Symphony Orchestra and really developed a big fan base in Asia and other parts of the world. Can you tell me more about that international legacy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Seiji, again, he had a huge following in Europe. The orchestras there, by and large, loved to have him come in and be a guest conductor. But along with the fan base or the audience that you might find in Japan and throughout Asia, he also had the backing of major corporations in Japan, which had its own benefits for the Boston Symphony, which wasn't in terrible shape in 1973. But like a lot of the economy at that particular time, it was a bit rough. Seiji opened the door to corporations like Sony and TDK and Nippon Electric, supporting the orchestra with their sponsorship. So again, the affection for Seiji in Japan and throughout Asia spread to the rest of the world, everywhere classical music was heard.
I know you didn't know him personally, but were there any aspects of Ozawa's personality that he was especially known for?
He became very well known around Boston for his enthusiasm for our sports teams. And you can find dozens of pictures of Seiji wearing a Red Sox hat or Red Sox jersey or coat. And he was constantly showing up at Fenway Park. Also a big fan of the Celtics and every other sport that was in Boston. The orchestra would make sure that he had access to the latest scores wherever he was, you know, how the Red Sox were doing in the standings, all of these things.
Oh, those kinds of scores.
Yeah. Of course, they supplied him with the scores he needed for his job, too. But yes, he was full of life. When you hear people talk about him, they speak of someone who was warm and generous. He was not uncontroversial, though. I mean, he made some moves during his time with the Boston Symphony that were hard-edged and almost ruthless. And so there is that side of him as an organizational leader where he took difficult decisions, was not well received at times, but that's part of the game of being a major league music director of a major orchestra.
Brian McCreath is director of production for GBH Music and broadcasts the Boston Symphony Orchestra on WCRB. This is Seiji Ozawa leading the BSO in Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
From PRX.